If you have a dyslexic child, you know that these are pretty cool kids. The problem is that their brilliance or creativity often ends up taking a back seat to their difficulties with reading or schoolwork. At Stoll Learning Centers, we're all about eliminating the challenges associated with dyslexia so that students can thrive in school. Part of thriving and living your best life is embracing your passions and talents. Today, we're taking a look at the upside of dyslexia and why helping your dyslexic learner nurture their unique abilities is so important. This is LD Expert Live. Welcome to LD Expert Live, your place for answers and solutions for learning differences, dyslexia, and attention challenges. I'm your host, Jill Stoll, founder of Stoll Learning Centers and author of At Wit's End, A Parent's Guide to Ending the Struggle, Tears, and Turmoil of Learning Disabilities. This book will help you understand why some bright children and teens struggle in school and what can be done to change that permanently. To get a free copy, go to parents@witsend.com. Our guest today is Dean Bragonier. Dean is the founder and executive dyslexic of Noticeability Incorporated, a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping students with dyslexia identify their unique strengths and build self-esteem. Welcome, Dean. It's so nice to have you here.
It's nice to be here.
Hey, I love your title, Executive Dyslexic. There's got to be a story behind that.
Well, yeah, sure. Executive Director is a common title for somebody who manages a nonprofit organization. I saw it as an opportunity to highlight the fact that I am dyslexic and that it's a dyslexic-centric organization. The ED was consistent, so why not keep that? And more importantly, it turned out to sort of underscore, one of my essential theses, whatever the plural is of thesis, is that one day when the world understands the cognitive advantages of dyslexia, everybody will want to have some sort of dyslexic designation. So I'm just being preemptive and putting it in my job title.
That's awesome. So tell us a little bit, if you're okay with it, I would love for you to tell us a little bit about your dyslexic journey as a student.
Sure. Sure. I mean, it's one of peaks and troughs, of course, and most of the troughs were early on. I did have the amazing benefit of having a very early diagnosis for somebody born in the early 70s. I was diagnosed at about third grade, which is a really progressive timeline, and fortunately had a family that was aware of what dyslexia was, my father being dyslexic, my mother being a child developmental psychologist. And we had sufficient resources to get me the reading intervention that I needed, and ultimately private education that allowed me to sort of thrive academically. I'm glossing over many years of struggle, and so much of that struggle provides the underpinning for what we do, what I do today, and it's the ancillary impact of a student with dyslexia, whether they receive or don't receive the intervention that they need. I, for one, having all those benefits, was still not insulated from this idea that as I was pulled out to go to what always seems to be the little classroom with the little desks and the little chairs, right, to get sort of fixed, that process of being pulled out of my peer group and being recognized as the kid that wasn't functioning correctly, translated to sort of a malignant self-esteem. And that self-esteem or lack thereof, continued to follow me through my educational career, even though I was able to at least take the path, unfortunately, less frequently chosen, which is, rather than raising the white flag and giving up, I said, all right, I'm going to prove everybody wrong, and I'm going to work three times as hard as everybody else to get the grades that I need in order to demonstrate that I'm not the stupid kid, right? And so I was able to manifest the sort of the academic output that allowed me to get into a very competitive private liberal arts college in the state of Maine called Bates College. And, you know, I still harbored that belief that, you know, somehow the admissions office had made a mistake, right? Like I didn't deserve to be there, right? That sort of imposter syndrome. But what was fascinating was that while I was at Bates, and the secret to success at a school like that is to do your best to come up with an original concept, a personal interpretation of the material being provided to you by your professors. If you spit back the way we do in high school, you know, rote answers, you know, you're sure to fail. And seeing the response that I was getting by very tentatively articulating my dyslexic, you know, perspective actually started to garner me attention in a positive light from professors and my peer group. And to get positive affirmation from people my age that are incredibly intelligent started to kind of chip away at this idea that I was somehow broken. You know, maybe I wasn't broken per se. Maybe I had a couple of idiosyncrasies that were both challenging at times and advantageous at others. And so that process, while I'd like to say that, you know, Bates was the panacea for my self-esteem, it wasn't, but it was the early sort of brick in the foundation that eventually grew and actually became quite sturdy as I transitioned from student to professional. Mm-hmm. And that is where I think most of us as dyslexics start to find irrefutable levels of success, because we no longer have to fit within this rigid sort of structure that is the educational system as we know it today. There's more to the story, but
well,
you got to stop me.
You know, thinking about that story, if we can just, it's kind of like our kids have 12 years in school, you know, that they've got to get through and somehow, you know, manage to get through with their self-esteem intact. And actually a lot of adult dyslexics will kind of have the experience where they really found their niche after they got out of school and were able to use their talents. But they think back to school and it was a really painful time because, they keep getting messages that you know, that they are broken or they look around and know they're not able to do it as well. Yeah. So the fact that you were diagnosed early, that is early third grade, especially then. And so the fact that you were diagnosed early, was naming the challenge helpful to you? Knowing what was going on.
Yeah, you know, very much so. And I know there's a lot of mixed feelings about, you know, the label. And I actually find the label to be very advantageous, because what it does is it takes the issue and externalizes it. I mean, obviously it's a part of us, but it is a component. It is not all of who we are. Much in the way that, you know, you might be a gifted musician or lousy at basketball, right? These are aspects of who we are. It's not enveloping all of us. So for me, that distinction was very, very useful. And it's something that my wife is dyslexic as well. We felt very strongly in sharing with our son as soon as he got diagnosed that he was dyslexic so he could understand it in this context. Now, you know, the flip side of that, and there's a strong movement for people first language, right? I am a person with dyslexia as opposed to I am dyslexic, right? And mm-hmm. and that distinction, I understand the importance and the nuance. Ironically, I think that we are very quick to identify ourselves as something when we associate that something with something. With an aspect that we're proud of. If you say, hey, I am American, or I am a hockey player, or I am, if it's a positive connotation, we designate ourselves as that. But if it's something that we might feel mixed feelings about, we the person first language. The irony is that I now say deliberately, oh no, I'm dyslexic. Like I am full on dyslexic. As I would say, you know, yeah, I'm a rocking, baseball player, which I'm not. But the point is that owning one's ability to manage that label, I think, gives the individual a lot more control on how mm-hmm. they perceive themselves and how they want others to perceive themselves.
And, you know, just thinking about students with dyslexia or other learning challenges, a lot of the time in school, they do not feel very in control. So I think that element is really, really important. You know, go ahead, Dean.
Well, I was just going to riff off that a little bit because I think that part of that is a fault, specifically a fault of those individuals who are adults who have achieved whatever their definition of success is, that we aren't more verbal about the fact that we are dyslexic. If the adults who have said, you know, I am either an astrophysicist or I am the best, refuse collector in my town, whatever your definition of success is, and you speak to the fact that you are dyslexic, then all of a sudden you're starting to tear down the stigma associated with that learning profile. And, you know, there are outspoken individuals. I think we need more of a spectrum of success. I mean, okay, we're not all going to be Charles Schwab or Einstein, right? But we may be very successful, small-time entrepreneurs. Great. The more we can verbalize that, I think the more the young child with dyslexia will start to question whether or not the sort of societal presumption is accurate or not.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Many states in the U.S. are putting in requirements now that students be screened for dyslexia early or that dyslexic students be supported. But what we're finding is there isn't a lot of education around that. And so while teachers are very compassionate, they don't really have an understanding of the dyslexic student's thinking style or needs. So in your experience, how are dyslexic students typically viewed in schools, and then what are the ramifications of that?
Sure, I will start with the disclaimer that I have yet to meet a teacher who goes into the profession because they make a lot of money, right?
Right.
Teachers are generally very dedicated, compassionate individuals that believe in positively affecting the lives of children.
Absolutely.
The fault in their lack of understanding of dyslexia actually falls, in my opinion, on the educational universities that they come out of. Because right now, and I work with some of the best in the country in Boston without naming names, I have asked professors in the ed school, how often does a soon-to-be teacher hear about dyslexia during their training? And they'll say, yeah, maybe like once or twice. And if that, it's in passing, right? Yeah, 20% on the high side are going to be dyslexic. And so I think the ramifications, and it's logical, but it's not right. The ramification is that a child who is dyslexic, who is going to do everything in their power to appear something other than dyslexic, because the intrinsic interpretation of my inability to learn how to read or spell is that I am stupid. And so therefore, I'm going to try to prove to you, the teacher, or those around you, that I'm something other than that. And if it means I'm the class clown and I wind up serving detention, it's a much better option than being seen as stupid, right? If I can go out and skip class and smoke cigarettes and drink beer, at least I'm respected as a rebel, right? I'm not perceived as a dumb kid. And so often I think that students with dyslexia, they as Martin Seligman, the father of learned helplessness, I believe these kids, myself included, are acquiring this level of learned helplessness very early on. Probably by third grade, most of them have fully acquired this psychological condition that no matter what they do, they're not going to be able to change their circumstances. And so what presents to the teacher is, oh yeah, they're struggling in reading, but boy, do they misbehave in class. They are a behavioral issue. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to, you know, label kids as behavioral issues or disengaged or lazy or whatever it is than to actually look at the underbelly of what's happening. And that goes back to the way that we teach reading in school and this archaic, antiquated model that's been around for Lord knows how long. And it's messing kids up because it's not teaching the dyslexics how to read properly through structured literacy. Did I answer your question? I feel like I went off on a diatribe, but
no.
I think they're really largely misunderstood by no fault of the teacher, but largely misunderstood.
Yeah, and I would agree with all of that. So ideally, I know you work quite a bit with schools. Ideally, what would you love for education for our dyslexic students to look like?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'd take a bulldozer to the entire educational system that we know today. It's predicated on this Prussian model of preparing essentially workers for the factory floors during the Industrial Revolution. It's as outdated as like lighting candles to illuminate your home. That said, we can't pivot the entire system as quickly as we'd all like. For the student with dyslexia, early screening, the laws that you mentioned are incredibly overdue but appropriate. And the implementation is a whole nother ball of wax. Who's going to hold the administrator's feet to the fire to make sure that the proper screening takes place? And then the proper diagnosis, right? Screening is one thing, diagnosis is a whole nother ball of wax. And as long as it's so cost prohibitive, and because the label of dyslexia carries with it legal mandates that require a much more expensive intervention, the whole system is somewhat stacked against a dyslexic diagnosis. Hmm. What we try to do is we try to say, look, well, let's recognize, let's not mince words about where our education is today. And the fastest way that we're going to be able to demonstrate the value of the dyslexic mind is by not necessarily arguing, which thank God many organizations do, about the legal requirements, structured literacy, et cetera. And I rely on them all to do that. But to also say, wait a minute, I'm going to show you how smart these kids are. Excuse me, let me put it differently. I'm going to create courses that allow you as the teacher to witness how brilliant these children are so that you are forced to question your own assumptions. What that means specifically is catering to the cognitive advantages associated with dyslexia that are emerging almost in real time as we speak, the advantages that account further down the line to the disproportionate rate of entrepreneurs and engineers and architects and artists that are all dyslexic. And if we can create an opportunity whereby these young kids can see irrefutable evidence of their own intellectual capacity, then they, I believe, will become so inspired and empowered that they will refuse to let the system continue to beat them down. Now, that's putting a lot of stock in the resilience and the resolve of a young child. But I think that right now, they're not getting much at all. They're getting really compassionate parents, the ones that are here for this talk today. And there are those beacons of inspiration coming from teachers that truly understand, and then paraprofessionals that are dedicated to supporting these kids. But I think we need to create a foot soldier of young empowered dyslexics so that as they matriculate out of school, they will have no qualms about saying, yeah, I solve global warming because I'm dyslexic. Don't you guys understand? It's my dyslexia that gives me that ability.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to talk specifically about those things in just a minute. Tell us, expand a little bit on that idea of cognitive advantage, the cognitive advantage of having dyslexia.
So it's a fascinating subject matter, and the book that I use as my sort of cornerstone of pedagogy is called The Dyslexic Advantage, written by Brock and Fernette Eide, and their book is really exceptional. What it does is it talks about their theory on dyslexia, and everybody's got a theory, and nobody really, really knows exactly why the brain does what it does. But more importantly, the second third and the last third of the book are devoted to a portfolio of these dyslexic advantages that they have identified that exist, albeit on a continuum, within people with dyslexia. And I read this book, and you must know that as a dyslexic, for me to say I read this book is a big statement. I read this book, and the truth that appears in these pages is irrefutable to me. I have witnessed it in my family members with dyslexia. I have witnessed it in myself. I've witnessed it in my son and the hundreds of kids that we have worked with. There are a predictable set of skills, again, on a continuum. Some may have high this, lower that, etc., that make these kids literally see the world through a lens that is not only fascinating and valuable, but I would say is quite literally innovative and revolutionary at times. And if you don't believe me, you know, why do we have light bulbs, Thomas Edison? Why do we have cars, Henry Ford? I mean, some of the greatest change agents in history have been dyslexics. And therefore, anecdotally, we can see that this has existed for decades, if not centuries. I would strongly urge anybody to read that book. We have a video on YouTube that outlines the MIND strengths. This is the acronym for Material Interconnected Narrative and Dynamic Reasoning. The video that we host on YouTube is part of one of our curriculum that highlights for a middle school aged appropriate language what these advantages look like. Mm. And a parent will be hard pressed not to go, oh, wow, I didn't know that my child could do that because of their dyslexia. I just thought they were naturally good at X, Y, and Z.
So your company, Noticeability, is focused on helping students with dyslexia identify these unique strengths and build self-esteem. So tell us about Noticeability, how it works, and all about it.
Yeah. Reading intervention is what needs to happen early on, and I rely on collaborators in the field like you who can get kids to that point where their reading is at a competent or confident level. What I think is critical at that moment is to intervene with strength-based narrative that the child can be exposed to contradict this belief that they have now been successfully fixed and they can masquerade as a normal person. We need that deficiency needs to be augmented with genuine self-esteem in order to give them a balanced perspective of themselves and prevent them from operating for a lifetime from this deficiency-based model. Mm. And so what we do is we've taken four of the top professions where dyslexics are disproportionately successful. That's entrepreneurship, engineering, architecture, and the arts. And we've distilled those, like I said, to an age-appropriate level, specifically middle school. Mm-hmm. And what we've done is we've taught the fundamental tenets of those professions using the modalities afforded to us through modern technology. Let me say that in a simpler way. We all have, as adults, these supercomputers called cell phones, right? And if a dyslexic wants to learn how to change a carburetor, I don't know. I don't even know if you change a carburetor, if you clean a carburetor. I can't. I could barely change a flat tire. But if somebody needs to change a flat tire, they will go to YouTube and watch a video. The modality of watching a video is much more organic for the dyslexic learner than picking out that manual and reading through the text. So we've taken all of our teaching and put it into video, graphic, infographic material so that it can be digested in a natural way for the dyslexic learner. Then either tutors or in school teachers have been trained on how to facilitate the project-based learning component. And the specific reason behind that is that our primary push, as much as it appears to be entrepreneurship or engineering, is actually social-emotional learning and executive functioning. Mm-hmm. Social-emotional learning is that ability to regulate oneself in group environments and to understand from a metacognitive level when conflict is arising, how to navigate it successfully, how to be an active listener, how to negotiate, all the skills that we as adults need, we as professionals need, but also individuals who may have created one of these protective shells, defensiveness or aggression or whatever it is, so that we can start to chip away at that. And when we chip away at those defense mechanisms, we're injecting this irrefutable evidence for the child to see, wait a minute, you mean I do that well because I'm dyslexic? I had no idea. And what that generates is I'd like to say permanent, but it's certainly a glimmer of authentic self-worth. And when a child with dyslexia who has for years, if not decades, believed that they are ineffective, finds a true, reliable source of their own self-efficacy, it becomes contagious. They cannot help but to pour themselves into that newfound enthusiasm. And one of the things that we're trying to emulate, and this goes back to the book, The Dyslexic Advantage, is a group of people that were interviewed by the authors, all of whom are global CEOs and entrepreneurs and stuff. They call them the 700 Club because each one of these individuals scored a cumulative of 700 or less on their SATs. And the authors say, with all due respect, how is it that you sort of changed your life trajectory from somebody who is, you know, performing this way to who you are today? And each one of them said, with the clarity as if it happened yesterday, the one person in their lives that stopped and articulated what they noticed that child did well at. Jill, you know, I had no idea that you were such a gifted artist. Or Jill, wow, you play a mean saxophone. You know, I mean, whatever it was. And that was all they needed to internalize and change their life trajectory. So we're trying to create a systemic opportunity for those kids that may not have that supportive home life or may not have that supportive educational environment to get that 700 Club moment for themselves. And I postulate that it can never be turned off if you really find what you're good at.
And I love that you are you've really targeted middle school for this, because it's, you know, before kids get to high school where they, you know, may just be so frustrated and angry that they've had it, they're done. You know, I think about, you know, what you said, once you got into college and gradually you started to recognize, hey, this is actually valued here. So, you know, if we can get kids recognizing that, and of course, in school, you know, there is a tremendous emphasis early on being able to read and write. And so, you know, they're just kind of surrounded by that challenge. And so I just love this piece of it that, yes, we need to do the remediation, but we also need to make sure that those talents and abilities are nurtured for them and brought to the forefront and not just pushed aside, which it can be because they're so burdened under the homework and trying to, you know, the hours and hours that it takes them to do it.
So and you know, it seems I pretend to be an armchair psychologist based only on what I read, but the idea is that they say that the personality that we formulate in the high school age tends to be the personality that we carry through life. And so if you are going into that phase of your life with this corroded self-perception, it's, you know, the cement of the personality, as my friend Ben Foss says, the cement of personality is going to get fixed then. We need to intervene while it's still wet and malleable, right? Mm-hmm. I think that breeding intervention plus genuine exposure to self-confidence is the winning equation.
So I love the picture that I've gotten in my mind of how noticeability works with small groups of kids who are really kind of learning and doing projects and exploring their thinking style together with other kids that are like-minded. So I think that's amazing. It's, I'm sure, a lot more powerful than, you know, saying to a child, hey, there are all these successful people out there with dyslexia. I mean, if they get together with their peers and they get to dig in, I can see how exciting that would be. What are some of the ideas or kind of aha moments that have come out of student groups doing that noticeability curriculum?
I guarantee we don't have enough time for that, but I'll tell you a couple of them. I'll tell you the ones that I can tell you about because literally, and these come mostly from our entrepreneurship course, there are teams that are working on ideas that they've come up with in the course that they are taking commercial. And I can't discuss it publicly because they're in the process of building a legitimate business. Now, remember, these are middle school kids, okay? For real. I think I'll share one story that was kind of funny, but only because of the timing of what happened afterwards. Dyslexic students, it appears, tend to have a disproportionate rate of compassion and empathy. And I think that probably is arrived as a result of always being on the short end of the stick. And so many of our students will identify, we go through a process of identifying a problem and then coming up with this unique solution and then building a business plan, a presentation to support that solution. Frequently, they will go after hunger, they will go after environmental issues, plastic in the sea, et cetera. As one group, I think there were three sixth graders, came up with this idea and had this whole presentation on a barge that they would construct and send out into the ocean to tackle, these huge plastic litter beds that exist that are the size of Texas. And it was a really complicated, really engineering sort of marvel of how it's got this scooping technique and then a recycling condensing plant on board, and then it gets put into cargo containers, offloaded and recycled for monetary value. And it was amazing. It was mind blowing. I thought to myself, okay, well, you know, just me to myself, I'm thinking, oh, that's great. It requires some fairly substantial overhead, but that's not the point. They feel great about what they've created, and it's an awesome solution to curing a real life problem. Literally 3 months later, it's probably less, about 3 weeks later, I've got a Google alert on dyslexia, right? So anything cool that happens online, I find out about through Google alerts. A Norwegian billionaire devotes his wealth to creating barges that will go out into the ocean to extract plastic and recycle it on board. And I'm like, this is what happens. First of all, him, great that he chose to allocate his billions, and not surprising he's dyslexic, but his exact business model is being emulated by three sixth graders in the United States. And you think to yourself, this is a pretty cool group of kids that we're working with that are otherwise overlooked. So that's just one example. Again, we could go all day.
But I love that. And, you know, I originally connected with you because you're so passionate about dyslexia. And I got really excited about learning about noticeability because our kids need opportunities like that to fit their, you know, that fit their thinking style and boost their sense of self-worth and self-esteem. And clearly they are going to help us solve the problems of our planet. So that's pretty exciting. At the learning centers, we have students of all ages who have dyslexia. Our goal is to eliminate the challenges associated with dyslexia, not by hammering in a lot of reading practice, but by building the underlying processing skills that need to be in place in order for reading and spelling remediation to make sense and stick. Often, our dyslexic learners have a brilliant ability to visualize ideas and things from many different perspectives, but holding a mental image of symbols, letters, and words is very challenging. Often they struggle with the auditory part of reading, so they work really hard to sound out every letter in the word, but they're so stuck in that process that they don't see the whole word or they miss the context of what they're reading. Or they're very good at grabbing the basic context of a sentence, but they don't notice really important words that don't evoke a strong mental image, words like not or except. So until the visual and auditory processing skills are built, reading continues to be slow or challenging. So I feel like it's really important to reiterate that addressing the root of the challenge is important. The roadblocks for dyslexic readers can be removed. But along with that, getting back to what Dean was talking about, their self-esteem is taking a huge hit every day, and they have these built-in abilities that can fuel them if we provide opportunities for them to do that. So, Dean, how does a parent help their child walk both sides of this issue, being open to the remediation that they need, and how can parents help find and nurture their dyslexic advantage?
Yeah, I love the work the Stoll Center does, but I would have never enjoyed going. and you know, it is critical that a family get their children the services that you provide. Right. It is. So it's a necessary step. It may not be a pleasurable step, but reminding your child that, to use an analogy that's probably age appropriate, look, the dyslexic has about 18 to 20 years of eating nothing but broccoli for the first 20 years of their lives. And then they get about 60 years of eating nothing but cake. Whereas the neurotypical, they crush it in school. They got 20 years of eating cake all along. Then they get out of school and it's like, oh, this is hard work. They got to eat broccoli for 60 years, right? Understanding that you're getting the tough part of life done first and you get to relish in the advantages and the fact that you've bolstered a work ethic that is second to none will benefit you for the rest of your life. So just it, not that your kids can all of a sudden go skipping off to tutor, but I think it gives context to the plight that is required of a student early on. The passion point is, I think, sometimes obvious, sometimes hidden, but my wife calls it that time when a child is losing time. meaning when a person is engaged in the activity, the learning, the drawing, the soccer, the whatever it is, where you have to come out and say, Billy, I said 20 minutes ago, we've got to go, stop. Or Judy, come down for dinner. What is taking you so long, right? Whatever they're doing, provided it's not like gaming, right? Although there's some educational gaming, but generally speaking, whatever they were doing is showing you what they were good at, what they were passionate about. Another example, and this is, you know, especially if it seems that boys love to take things apart, myself included, right? If the kid's taking apart the lawnmower, right, their first inclination is, okay, your allowance is now mine until I buy a new one, right? Or that's pretty sophisticated. That's actually what people call mechanical engineering. Now, let's see if you're really good. Can you put it back together, right? The point is that there are little micro perspectives of these talents that if we can recognize them and we can support, provided they're productive and not detrimental, support those opportunities where they are losing time, then I think we're going to start to feed in to the genuine passion of these kids and give them that inherent sense of self and self-worth that they desperately need. So it's just kind of a challenge that I pose to us as adults to say, really look, what is it? If they can't stop throwing that lacrosse ball against the wall, fantastic. Let's get them into some extra camps or some clubs or have them intern at the high school team or whatever. But feed it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think about if you think about some of the talents that students have, you know, maybe they really are great at building things. I mean, we have, you know, Lego tables in our waiting rooms when we were allowed to use our waiting rooms, but because our kids build these amazing Lego structures. Well, you know, you may have a child that loves architecture or building things, but they kind of hate doing their math homework. Well, you know, if we put some context around that, you know, they've got this brilliant ability to see it. Now let's get the math that has to go with it so that they can really, you know, build a profession out of it. So kind of marrying that.
Jill, you're so spot on, right? So spot on. Minecraft is another one. I mean, that's one of the video games that I think is actually quite productive. I mean, once you get away from killing zombies and stuff like that, but just the structure and the mining things and all the executive functioning that goes into planning and everything in Minecraft, these are really productive. And it's also engineering and it's also architecture and it's also city engineering, et cetera. But you just nailed it on the head, which is goes back to the earlier question is what would you do to change education? I'd provide a little bit of the answer as to why before we go through 12 or 16 years, like just as you said, you know, you're building a fort. That's fantastic. That's actually called architecture. When you get to something called geometry, you're going to totally want to pay attention because architecture is predominantly squares, triangles, and circles. And that's what geometry does. So if you want to build fancy forts for the rest of your life, check out geometry. The kid is all of a sudden like, okay, geometry is relevant, but that's not how we do it. We say, good luck, survive if you can. And once you get out, we'll tell you why all the stuff you studied was necessary.
It's like, right. What? And, you know, that really would be helpful for every student. Our dyslexic students usually have very good comprehension. And so as soon as you can give them a bigger context, it makes all the difference. But actually, so many students go through school and they're like, why do I have to learn this? And, you know, somewhere way later in life, they're like, oh, I see how that applies. Well, if we give them that context on the front end, it is going to pique their interest a little bit more, I think.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
This is LD Expert Live. I'm Jill Stowell, founder of Stowell Learning Centers, and we're talking to Dean Bragonier about dyslexia. I love talking to people who are out to change the world. And Dean, you definitely are doing that for children and adults and families who have dyslexia as a part of their story. What would you like to leave our viewers with today?
I think, look, you know, we couldn't do our work without professionals like you, Jill, who are doing your work, right? You can't have an overconfident, illiterate dyslexic and call them empowered, nor can you have a fully literate, insecure dyslexic and call them empowered. It's a joining mm-hmm. of those two factions that needs to happen mm-hmm. in order to give the holistic experience. But above and beyond that, you know, I think the main fundamental, irrefutable panacea is a parent, mom, dad, caregiver, whatever it looks like, who is dedicated to their child with dyslexia. They will kick, they will scream, they might even call you bad names, but they will never forget that you were there mm-hmm. throughout the entire experience. And one day, they will thank you. One day. It may take a few decades, but they will thank you because they know you were there. And selfishly, we need to get this population empowered. Like, not only for the individual, that goes without saying, every one of our kids with dyslexia deserves the full shot to live out their best life and reach, as Maslow talks about, that self-actualization tier. But as important, our society globally does not realize, they really don't yet realize, that some of our greatest change agents are literally being paid by society to incarcerate, to rehabilitate from drug and alcohol abuse, when in actuality, they are the ones that hold the keys to unlocking many of the problems that, no offense intended, neurotypicals haven't been able to figure out. We are resting on a renewable source of innovation that we're literally paying to keep behind closed doors. That is a travesty, not only for the individual, but society at large. So I often kid, although I'm totally serious, but don't tell anybody, I'm like a full-born dyslexic elitist. Like, I love dyslexia. Like, I love the way these kids think. I mm-hmm. adore them. And whenever I get in a room full, I strap on my seatbelt and I grab a hold of the armchair because I am going for a ride. I dare you to join us in letting the world know. Because once they do, dyslexics will be something. It'll be right below your name on your resume because it'll give you a competitive advantage.
Well, thank you for that. You know, I have to say, I do not have the dyslexic advantage, but the reason the Learning Center exists is because I fell in love with that population of students. So,
Jill, remember, nobody's perfect. That's just kidding. Thank you for empowering all my little siblings. We're such a worthwhile population, as you well know. So
that
thank
is
you.
For sure. Well, thank you, Dean, for your work, your passion, and for sharing with us today. Here is Dean's contact information. Noticeability provides a really special opportunity for dyslexic students to connect with like-minded students around their strengths and talents. It is offered remotely, so check it out at noticeability.org. This is LD Expert Live, your place for answers and solutions for learning disabilities, dyslexia, and attention challenges. Stowell Learning Centers are open for both on-site and remote sessions and evaluations. We work with children and adults doing targeted brain training to permanently eliminate struggles associated with dyslexia, auditory processing, and other learning differences so that students can become independent learners and thrive in school. If you would like a free consultation for yourself or your child, give us a call or visit our website at stowellcenter.com. Thank you again, Dean.